by Caroline Duffy. She's poet laureate at the moment, I think.
In England.
Okay, it's called M.M. Memory. As in memory. Scooping spilt, soft, broken oil with a silver spoon from a flat stone floor into a clay bowl. Dull scrape of the spoon on the cool stone, lukewarm drops in bowl. M.M. Memory. Kneel there, words like fossils, trapped in the roof of the mouth, forgotten, half recalled. The tongue dreaming, it can change their shape. Names, ghosts, and memory. Through the high window of the hall, clouds up escape the sun, and you sit, exhaling grey smoke into a purpling religious light, trying to remember everything perfectly in time and space, where you cannot. Those unstringed beads of oil seem precious now that the light has changed.
Thank you, Rita. Next we have Grant March.
All right.
The opening couple of paragraphs from a Salman Rushdie book called Harun and the Sea of Stories. It's a book he wrote for his kids to kind of explain the concept of censorship when the fatwa was put on him when he wrote Midnight's Satanic Verses. There was once, in the country of Alif Bay, a sad city. The saddest of cities, a city so ruinously sad that it had forgotten its name. It stood by a mournful sea full of glumfish, which was so miserable to eat that they made people belch with melancholy, even though the skies were blue. In the north of the sad city stood mighty factories, which, so I'm told, sadness was actually manufactured, packaged and sent all over the world, which never seemed to get enough of it. Black smoke pulled out of the chimneys of the sadness factories and hung over the city like bad news. And in the depths of the city, beyond an old zone of ruined buildings that looked like broken hearts, there lived a happy young fellow by the name of Harun, the only child of the storyteller Rashid Khalifa, whose cheerfulness was famous throughout the unhappy metropolis. Harun grew up in a home in which, instead of misery and frowns, he had his father's ready laughter and his mother's sweet voice raised him strong. Then something went wrong. Maybe the sadness of the city finally crept in through the windows. Harun guessed there was trouble brewing, but he never suspected how much.
That's great. And next, could we please welcome Charles Clark.
Cloud and so on. This is called Grasmere Bats and Ironies. How small the rooms were. We saw a tea caddy and a lock, a portrait of Mrs. Wordsworth, May Hutchinson. There were no daffodils, and we missed the bell room. The guide pronounced plain living and high thinking. And reproving tone. On our way up to Keswick, and beyond, we had spent a night over a pub in Clitheroe, lunched at Stonyhurst, and seen the treasures of that great half palace. Had the luck to be shown the vestments, gold cloth from the field of cloth of gold, Henry VIII and Francis of France. There were other reminders of events from Papal Rome and its decadence, the French Revolution, representing it. What history teaches, said Gertrude Stein. What did she know? Did she ken John Peel? Did she meet, like she met, Arrhenius? There is more to the Lake District than lakes and fells, more than Ruskin and more.
Thank you, Charles. And next on the list we have, we haven't seen him in ages, Seamus Harrington.
Trade winds. Seaman Adams, sole surviving mutineer, 40 years on. For a box of pencils and paper, I will trade Cook's final three volumes, their margins trimly notated by Bligh, saved from our blazing or flaming hull. If it please the Creator, grant me freedom to live out my days with this community reliant on me. Let bygones be bygones. Amen.
Thank you. Thank you. And next, please, could we welcome Mary O'Connell.
Apparently, global warming is caused by human intervention, and this is a poem about the North Pole, basically, I suppose. It's called Meltdown. Snow burrow deep, bears sleep, spring begins to crack, wedges of ice shear off, slice an agitated sea. Pearl sheen sweeps to puckered edge under rush of streams. Ice flows, sails drifting on glass crumble stealthily. Cobalt shadows bite into a fragile, shimmering expanse. Shrinking wilderness, naked in the glare of a sinister sky. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And we have him already at the mic, Donald Maloney.
I'll read the small excerpt from the story I read at the start of it last week. There's not too much backstory. This guy's brother-in-law comes along and ruins his morning, and that's about it, and blocks his toilet, and gives out about his sister, and that's where it starts here. The brother-in-law's talking on the phone to somebody else, and he says, "Jamie boy, how are we getting on?" he shouted. "Out with me brother-in-law. The arse end of nowhere." No, I came to Waterford to see Elaine, didn't I? But she's not there. Are you around yourself? Fair enough. No bother. But anyway, let me tell you. He left the room and walked to the far end of the corridor between the bedrooms. The corridor channeled his voice straight back to me, though, and I heard him complain to his friend or cousin or whatever about Elaine not wanting him to see Des. But Elaine did want him to see Des. She just wanted him to look after her properly as well. Whenever Mossy brought Des out to Dungalvin, where he lived alone in a dirty flat, she'd come back either hungry or sick with sweets, sunburnt or wet and cold, and always overtired. It was the same ever since he and Elaine broke up. For the next year, Des had almost constant nappy rash because Mossy never changed from time. It'd be just about clearing up by the end of the week, and then came Saturday and Mossy, and back to square one. And yet, to be fair, Mossy adored Des. I think that's the best word for it. His feelings for her were intense and constant. He had the deep-seated belief that his presence alone was essentially good for her. He was very gentle with her and showed her lots of affection. He was also very conscious of his own love. So yes, he adored her. Des was the centre of his life. And while we're being fair to Mossy, I should admit that he never really changed. I see punters like him all the time. They have their shtick and that's great until suddenly it's unbearable. By the time Elaine found out how annoying and useless Mossy was, she was pregnant. I'll leave it there.
Next, could we welcome Anthony Durity.
This is not my own, it's by a guy called Richard Broskin, or Broskin, I'm not sure, a countercultural poet. And I don't think there are enough poems about robots at all, and I think people should write more poems about robots. I would read a poem about robots if I had written a poem about robots, but I haven't.
Robots.
I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony like pure water touching clear sky. I like to think, right now please, of a cybernetic forest filled with pines and electronics where deer stroll peacefully past computers as if they were flowers with spinning blossoms. I like to think it has to be of a cybernetic ecology where we are free of our labors and joined back to nature, returned to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace.
Thank you very much, Andre. Next, we have Rosie O'Regan.
This is called The Weight of Writing, and it's hopefully going to become part of a kind of a live installation. That's the idea anyway, so I wouldn't mind some feedback afterwards, if that's okay. Words placed on a page cast shades of meaning, feather out toward light, sink into skin, swim, inhale to where breath begins, where voice becomes wind. Understanding softly sung resonates within. Tactility of touch, pen pearl of black ink on white sheet invites a type of character, maps directional lines, curve with leaves that turn words into stone, muscle, bone, hands need to hold. Shape shadows of thought, fold symbolism into worlds, visceral imprints caught in suspension, express attention, dissolve flesh into ink made roadways, real, unreal, surreal, play with all things malleable, create books of memory without plugs, destined, penned to paper's weight.
Thank you. Thanks, Rosie. Next we have Reb or Garch.
This is also a poem of workmanship, I suppose. Come Get a Mortgage. Houses built from cardboard with garages stuck on. You're a bunch of silly fuckers and you're all being conned. But never mind that. Come and get a mortgage, danced the Barrett way. Not built for tomorrow, just shown up today. Nigel bought a wimpy house, he thought he was a toff. The day the guarantee ran out, the fucking doors fell off. But never mind that, come and get a mortgage, dance the Barrett way. Not built for tomorrow, just shown up today. Johnny had a party, he invited all his kith and kin. And when they started dancing, the fucking floor fell in, but never mind that. Come and get a mortgage. Dance the bar away. No milk for tomorrow. Just shown up today. 10-year building guarantee on a 25-year mortgage. Do you know, one of the biggest house building, sorry, home building companies in Scotland is called Hassel Homes. What do you think you get when you buy a Hassel home? Oh, it's a fucking hassle, but never mind that. Come and get a mortgage. Dance the bar away. Not built for tomorrow, just thrown up today. Hey.
Thanks, Ryan. Next, I think, is it Des Brown? Des, is it? Des Brown.
It's called War Medal, and it's about a war medal that my grandfather dug up when he was younger, and it's become something of an heirloom, so it's called War Medal. My grandfather just dug it up one evening, a chance find, still undigested in the grueling appetites of the clay, ribbonless, all bluish flecks, but delicious with a prune-dark antiquity, and his shovel sunk upright till he cleans it. I can imagine still, down those dry, crumbling fathoms of crust, the smeared roots and the astounding nip of water as it touches bottom, where the blade aborts, delivered down how much unsayable. Lodged so and elusive, dirt-layered, detectable to no blackbird's head cocked her damp, earthy rhythms, it came like blood from a stone, the pit stone in the peach, what is not to love. Once I took it with me for light handling as I walked the wet fields, a family marsh of toadstools and mossy stone, the boar tree darkly weighed, and all were names to conjure with. One day I'll cast my another look up to the snow-packed gullies of Galty Moor, criss-crossing, and see again the thatched cottage, crumbling now, where it was found lathered in wet soil, and feel it fostered in my palm to fresh significance.
Thank you, Des. Next we have our reigning five-word champion, John McNally.
Egg timing. I was glad when I finished my eggs, poached, before the ladies at the next table started talking about their eggs, unfertilized.
Thank you, John. And thanks for the gravity. Please, now could we welcome, he's come all the way from western part of the world, Mr. Louis Mulcahy.
I wasn't going to read this, but I'm also a craftsman, so I read this for Adam. Tsunami. I threw a pot, a clay pot, flared belly, collared neck, thinking as I worked, and my thoughts were all of you. Tracing past the pain, backwards down the decades, we were blind to fortune's gifts. And then I threw a bigger pot, in which to store those thoughts, trawling through the years before your fate engulfed the structure we had built, great hewn blocks overturned and shattered by one malevolent wave. I didn't make another pot, just assembled the old shards. But when I tried to put the past back in that well-glued pot, I found it wouldn't fit. for memory had expanded all the treasure once compressed under weight of daily life.
Thank you, Louis. Just three readers left now. So could we now welcome Mr. Dor Harding.
Hurling matches, and they were probably the greatest ones I've ever seen. I saw my first All-Ireland in 1966, and I was reading all about them, the reviews and the Examiner printed something on the Saturday before last, Friday before last Ireland's match, an article by a fellow called Kevin Brophy. I'd never heard of him, but turns out he's a novelist. He's from Galway, and he has a critically acclaimed novel called The Berlin Crossing, which came out in the past year, and he wrote about he was at the 1953 All-Ireland Final, where he saw Stirling Fane, and Recently he was in the hospital with his father, and his father was dying, and he went into the room anyway, so a man was there for bed, and he was asleep, and when he woke up he said to Kevin, I was dreaming. And Kevin said to him, what are you dreaming about? And he said, I dreamt of feelings. And I'd written a poem about 6 months prior to this called Feelings. And this is it. Feelings. I dreamt of feelings, old feelings. My house is in the middle of a field, surrounded by fields. I met my mother before her marriage, hemmed in a factory, stitching socks, and not a book in sight. And my father, thinning turnips for the devil, who didn't even eat them afterwards, fresh out of the oven. And our pet dog, with the face of a bull, eager to eat me up in one cub. Luckily, I awoke and was glad it was in a bed in my house, in the middle of a field. I looked out to see nothing but ditches, cows, trees, birds, and everything the field holds, and beyond it, the sea, the sumptuous sea.
Thank you, Dor. Next, we have Cedric Picard.
The phone rings again for the seventh time today. The ring bell leaves me a second within which I swear, curse, and pray. These customers ring again for the 13th time this week. Yet another critical issue. It just turns out to be yet another test for my patience growing weak. One more of my smiles rings again. I'll keep my teeth behind my lips. I'm paid to suck it up, and it will hurt me more than you, I promise. The next one to me rings again, crying for the help one cannot afford. But I won't judge, since I will charge your problem will write my name on the leaderboard. My thing is broken, for gain you will lie. So am I, again I won't reply. we are all consumers. You of it, me of you. I hold no pride for the rules to which I comply. I live for food, smile for gain, or maybe the way around. Being forgetful numbs any pain, either yours or mine, so tightly bound.
Thank you, Cedric. I know we're running slightly late. We've got one more reader, and then we're probably going to vacate the premises fairly sharply, or there will be consequences. Could we please welcome to the mic for the last reading of the night, Jack Corbett.
In the name of avoiding dire consequences, I'll make a short one. This was going to be a poem about a city, but it never quite got there. I wanted to talk to you about your most recent adventure. When you walked through your hometown at 4 a.m. in your grandfather's jacket. You know, as I do, that there is an hour between the end of desperate revelry and the repentant dawn, when the streets are only austere. In such a space, bridging sighing hours of twilight, you were too aware of your reflection in the Shakespearean mirror held up by vacant pavements. You alone watched the way your coattails hung, or how your feet fell in that peculiar rolling gait from your bad knee that you maintain demystifies you. Between the cold key, the river, the places that have owned you, you ask the world that you have made to see the you you have created. I wanted to walk with you on your next outing, watching you perform the act you have perfected. With empty streets, your willing stage. For you and they alone are raptured watching crowds.